And it's important for us to try to think through the issues together, even though, of course, these issues do raise powerful emotions in all of us. Now, Udo is going to join me here for the discussion. And please, if any of you have a question, could you come to the microphone and speak it, because the questions haven't been being picked up by the tape recorder, and we'd appreciate it if they could be. So if you'd like to stick up your hands, if somebody wants to get started, please, if you'd like to come down to the microphone.
One of the things that really concerns me as I recognize the power of the media is that so many are vocal referring to their fear of nuclear warfare, etc. And because the church seems to be so afraid, as a pastor, since I've been here, especially since I'm from the U.S., I've been scared to death to even approach the subject for fear of the confrontation it would cause or the anger. But as Christians, how do we come together on a consensus, and how do we speak to the world? Because I get letters all the time from home, and because of the news media, people say, do people really not want us to protect them? Does New Zealand want us just to forget that they exist? And there's so much money and so many taxes being spent to be a deterrent. And a lot of the U.S. people I know are angry that they're putting out so much money and nobody wants it, or at least they act like they don't. Yes. And I'm wondering, how do the Christian church come together? How do we become a voice to say, well, maybe everybody's not against it?
Thank you. Do I need to summarize that a bit? No. Okay. Thank you. Now, let me just say something, and I'll hand over to Udo to respond to you. First of all, I'd really want to challenge all of you Australians here, and New Zealanders too, as I know there are a few of you, to really think seriously about your whole attitude to the United States and also the way your media presents them. Because I must say, I think there is a shameful misrepresentation of the actualities. If anything is shown, for example, about American Christianity, certainly in Britain, I'm sure it's the same here, it's always the worst possible excesses that are shown. Whereas in fact, the church there is far stronger than anywhere else I've ever been, and has far more good things going for it than in most other places. And I really like to challenge you, just as Christians, to try to think more soberly about the way things really are there, both in terms of the realities in the church and also in terms of the reality in the state, as I said earlier, that we really need to be realistic and to recognize that we're in a moment of history where it's the in thing to do to knock the United States at every point. Now, you know, in response to the first part of your question, I think that when people frighten everybody by producing programs about what will happen in the event of a nuclear war, we have to make the point that what they are talking about is a possibility that may happen in the future. What is far more important is that we actually look at the situations which really exist in the world right now. I think Christians really do need to understand much more seriously and carefully what the situation actually is in places like the Soviet Union and in the rest of the Eastern Bloc. So they really understand the kind of things that their fellow Christians are going through and that the citizens are going through. And I'd encourage you all to read things by people like Solzhenitsyn and Vladimir Bukovsky, another Russian dissident who's exiled to the West, which describe the situation there. So that we look at what the real situation is and not what may happen, but what the situation actually is, which we need to be dealing with. Udo, I don't know if you'd like to add anything here before we go on.
Yes, I think in reference to the first part of what Jerome was saying, There's an element in which psychologically it's very understandable that those that are smaller or weaker or younger feel a certain need to distance themselves to the stronger, older, etc. You find that in the human family where you have the adolescent reaction against the parents, and there comes a certain time when it's very difficult to discover anything about your parents that is any good, and that you wouldn't change once you come off age. And there's an element of that in our relationship to, in a sense, the need in a crazy world for somebody to give some kind of a direction, which is not always, does not always come across as all wise and all considerate and pooling all the information that might be available. The Canadians feel a bit the way you do about the United States, and that is when the elephant moves, the whole bed shakes. But then, and you mustn't sort of translate the actions of the American Tuna Fish Association as representative of 240 million people. New Zealand feels that same way about you Australians. Again, the smaller in relationship to the larger. The second thing is that there's a very vocal anti-Americanism that is really born out of two things. One is, I think, a deliberate agenda, what we've been talking about, to really undermine the very affirmation of the individual person being created in the image of God, a certain element of freedom and creativity, etc. That's what we've been talking about in some of the sessions. But it's also coupled with what I would like to say in relation to the second part of Jerem's answer, and that is a tremendous amount of ignorance, historically speaking. I mean, do we really go back and study the track record of those that we blame and accuse of all sorts of things? Do we really understand something of the basic underlying philosophy of life in this tremendous mixture of America, where in today's society you really don't have any other parallel of the tremendous freedom to discuss, to explore, to take risks, to leave everything behind and try something new? I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of freedom. And to take that which all that freedom produces as an evidence of a new world dominion or Western imperialism just has nothing to do with either the facts or the track record, especially when you compare it with the other side, where you have a declared purpose of world domination. As in the dialectic materialism, you basically have no restraint, because it's dialectic, and you wish to dominate the whole world with one form of government, with one social order, destroying every evidence of what makes you, each of you, unique as people. That's the declared philosophy for all of life in the Soviet bloc. And if you compare the two, we really have to do our homework better and have the courage to stand up and demand that people explain themselves and point out that there are dramatic differences between the two, and that in many, many ways, in most ways, they cannot be compared except in terms of size.
Could somebody tell me, please?
Do you want to come a bit closer to the microphone and we'll make sure it picks you up?
Could somebody please let me know how Switzerland faces such a situation? They are free from either side, neutral. How do they face this situation on their own with no backup from NATO, no backup from USSR? What do they do as a nation so as we could know? If we are without this help from America, what we as a nation would have to face, what situation?
Now, I'll just say a little bit, and then I'll hand you over to Udo, because he actually lives there, so he knows far more about it than I do. But I would just say Switzerland has a history of neutrality and not having been invaded for quite a long time. And the reason is not because it's a peace-loving nation in the sense that it's peace-loving by laying down its arms. Rather exactly the opposite. It's always been much too costly for anybody to invade it because it's been so very well prepared and so very well armed. But Udo can tell you a little bit more about practically what the situation is like there.
Yeah, I actually mentioned that in my talk this afternoon, that every Swiss male goes to basic service when he is 18 and then belongs to the army for 3 weeks every year until the age of 55. And during those 3 years, he goes into uniform and shoots with live ammunition in actual maneuvers. because precisely in the whole approach to reality, two things stand out to me. One is that we don't live in a peaceful universe after the fall. And there are many enemies you need to be prepared to face. And secondly, that the degree of your preparedness to defend, to that degree, the life and ideas and freedoms and social forms, etc., are something worth to you. If you're not willing to defend it, it really is a matter of indifference as to whether it remains this way or changes. And therefore, they're armed to the teeth. We actually live in one of the areas where during World War II, one of the three mountain fords was established in the approach from the western plains, France and Germany, towards Italy and the central part of the mountains. And there we have a gigantic ford with its own power plant, a diverted river under the mountain. We have all sorts of little cubicles in the mountains that you see as you drive, with ladders going up and false rocks hiding the gun positions. We have tank traps on all the roads leading to passes that are checked every 6 months, iron steel girders coming out of the ground, and gun positions that face each one of the bends so that you can get the trucks as they come across, etc., etc. It's a country that's armed to the teeth. Plus a social factor, and that is that, as I was saying this afternoon, that if you belong to the few, maybe 200, who recently, largely influenced through liberal Protestant theology, have chosen to become conscientious objectors. The court's decisions are always based on the fact that if you are a conscientious objector, you are in fact setting your own principle above that which is historically Switzerland, and therefore you do not deserve to be a fully accredited Swiss citizen. And thus, any government office is closed to you because you don't represent the country. You have a right to be Swiss and have a passport after you've been through 6 months of prison instead of the 6 months of basic training. And then you... That's true. And then you pay a fine every year for not doing military service, which is equal to those who pay the fee... because they have a bad back and cannot walk. You contribute that way, but you are not, in the same sense, a fully accredited Swiss, because you've separated yourself from that which has been precious to the people. Now, the other thing is that though Switzerland is neutral, you must realize that neutrality does not mean that you don't have a viewpoint. Neutrality only means that others will respect you and not attack you by you offering to be neutral. And you must in some way practice that neutrality through, let us say, the Red Cross, which is, after all, a Swiss organization. It's the reversal of the Swiss flag. You see, we have a white cross on the red, etc. The Red Cross working in both camps, and Geneva being there as a place of mediation, and the Swiss ambassador taking the representation for the Americans in Cuba, as well as the Russians somewhere else. So it's neutral in that sense, but it's not neutral in the mindset of the people. And they very much understand that their protection beyond that degree of defensive stance which they have as a nation lies in its tie-up with the West. So much so that a couple of years ago the Russian embassy protested that the press and public opinion in Switzerland was too far on the Western side. And then one more thing, if I may say that, on the celebration of the 4th of July, which is the American Independence Day in Geneva, this last year we went because they had a genuine American football game there. There was the socialist member of the Geneva Parliament who gave a speech. And it being 1984, he brought out the point that had it not been for the American and other allied courageous intervention on the European continent on D-Day, Normandy, in 1944, we would not be able to have this celebration in freedom today. So their allegiance is very clear. Neutrality does not mean that you become ignorant or even naive about the need to take a very clear stand in favor of the human being against a worldview to which the human being, as seen in the scriptural reference, is really anathema.
Of interference as far as the matter of the church is concerned, rather than conversely, that the Anabaptist position held that the state has no role and task in society, and that by implication, in terms of the way the argument has been developed, that therefore the Anabaptist position was that the state then also should not be involved in taking up the sword and so on.
Okay, perhaps if I can respond to that before you go on to the next one. Of course, I gave a very brief representation of the position. However, the point I was making was this. Not that they were saying that the state shouldn't have any power at all, but rather that no Christian should be in the state. And they said that very, very clearly. And that's what they meant when they said that the magistrate's office is outside of the perfection of Christ, that it's carnal. Or to make another statement, they said no ruler is a Christian and no Christian is a ruler. In other words, the complete rejection of the idea that a Christian could take such an office because to do so would be disobedient to Christ. Now, I wasn't suggesting that they said that the state had no responsibility to maintain order in its society. That is a quite separate question, and they recognize that in the kingdom of this world that those things happen. However, they did go on to say that rulers should not resist sedition and invasion. So while they allowed the state to have power internally, they encouraged not just Christians, but also the state itself to not fight wars. So I don't think that I misrepresented their position.
Okay, but maybe the thing that that I think should be emphasised was that the Anabaptists did pay taxes in order to support the state, so that it wasn't, as so often the Calvinist tradition has in fact suggested, that they were anti-state in a totalistic kind of sense. I believe that except for taxes as related to war, they withheld that.
I wasn't arguing that they were completely anti-state. Though, I think if you look back over the points that I made, that wasn't a point that I made. I was talking rather about the Christian's place in the state and what this meant for a Christian, not about their attitude to the state as such.
Okay.
So I accept that point.
Okay. Okay, the second question relates to the seeming extrapolation of the way that God called the Old Testament people to wage war, which to me seems to be war based on revelation, and then to kind of extrapolate from that to war in general. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could comment on that, because right. It seems that you just can't argue from the one to the other.
Yes, I would acknowledge there are differences between the kind of holy war you have in the Old Testament and the war that a state might fight today. There are obvious differences. One is, of course, that you had direct revelation from God as to when the war was to be fought. Another is that the people of God are identified with a particular geographical situation, with a particular nation. However, recognizing those differences, I would suggest that just as in the rest of the Old Testament law, there are some fundamental principles at stake which apply today. And that's why I was appealing to Paul in the New Testament, because Paul recognizes that the kind of view of government which existed within Israel, God desires in all the nations. Now, of course, it's not exactly the same, so that today it's not the business of a government to put to death false prophets, for example, as it was the business of Israel in the Old Testament, because the church is called to go out into the whole world and proclaim the gospel. It can't be identified with any particular nation. It's a pilgrim people scattered all over the face of the earth in many different kinds of situations. So, of course, there are differences. But Paul argues that the same basic view of government and its purposes still exists. That government is to be seen as something which is a ministry pleasing to God, and where the government has a responsibility to protect its citizens. In fact, what I did was to extrapolate from police duty, policing, defending one's people against criminals, to the necessity of defending one's people against invaders, because I don't think one can make any logical distinction between the two. And I think that distinction has been, if you like, fundamental to the whole Anabaptist tradition, as you suggested yourself, that they recognized the state had power, but they didn't acknowledge that it had the right to resist invasion or even sedition. In other words, they set very strict limits to it. I don't see those limits being drawn by Scripture, and nor do I see them being drawn by, if you like, common sense, I would say. I don't mean to be rude, but I'd say common sense, because in using my illustration of the people from outside of from the countryside coming and attacking Brisbane at night, or people coming across the sea in boats, it seems to me a government's responsibility is clear in those circumstances. I'd want to go on and say that there is another way, too, in which I think governments are called to wage war on occasion, and that is out of love for their neighbours. That I don't see such commandments in the New Testament as applying only to personal situations, but rather to the whole of life. And that as nations we have a responsibility to other nations round about us. I think, for example, that before the last war, it would have been far better if the Allies had intervened earlier on behalf of the other nations of Europe, instead of simply sitting tight and hoping it wouldn't affect them. So I would suggest that there are two grounds in which I would want to defend war. The one is resistance of invasion by an enemy, and the second would be out of love for a neighbour in seeking to help him, just as one would do on the individual level if one saw somebody being attacked.
Time for one more?
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, they're very helpful questions because they really expose some of these issues.
Really what I'd like to do, I'd like to tie in your discussion of Romans 13 to Udo's discussion earlier.
Do you want to stand right next to the microphone? I'm sorry. Otherwise
Udo's discussion earlier this afternoon. about the fact that the church made an active resistance against Hitler. Now, in the first place, I think that's a misinterpretation of what in fact happened. I don't believe that the Protestant church as such made that stand against Hitler. In fact, very few individuals did. Bonhoeffer being one of them, when he had already resigned as a pastor, knowing the kind of implications of his position. And how that kind of inability of the church to take a stand is linked in with the kind of interpretation that I think you're suggesting as far as Romans 13 is concerned. Mm.
Okay, I'll leave Udo to answer the particular situation about Christians in Germany under Hitler. But I would say this just in general. Of course, none of us is suggesting that it's easy to be objective in one's judgment of one's own society. Of course it's difficult. And the fact, however, that it's difficult doesn't mean the Christian doesn't have an obligation to do that. It seems to me one is being presented with two alternatives. Simply, the one is to either say, well, we won't be involved in this at all because it's impossible for us ever to be sufficiently objective about our own societies to judge when their wars are just and when they're unjust. Or secondly, that we have to get involved in that struggle to try to determine what is right. And I would say we have to go for that one. Otherwise, as Christians, we become completely separated from the society. And I think this was, again, though there's been a real shift in the Anabaptist position, that was really the position they took in the 16th century, to say there is such a radical division between the kingdom of Christ and the church and the kingdom of this world, that the only calling for the Christian is to separate oneself completely from this situation and be a witness to it by being a light to it. Now, and that, of course, they did wonderfully. And everybody would acknowledge that in their communities they were able to display all kinds of things which were very special. An alternative way of life, of caring for one another, and so on. And still do to this day. However, it seems to me that's only one half of the Christian's calling. We are all called to be a light to the world in which we live, to the society around us, to display something different in the way that the early Anabaptists did, to live by a different set of standards than they saw in many of the people around them. But we're also called to be the salt of the earth. And that is to be penetrating the society and actively involved in it. And again, you see, I think if we look at the Old Testament and we see the encouragement there for believers to be actively involved in the administration of justice, it's not done in a naive way. The Old Testament is one of the most realistic books I think any of us can ever have read in talking about the sinfulness of governments, the sinfulness of people in office. But God doesn't call his people to give up the struggle to reform the situation, to bring justice into the situation. And it seems to me that's what the Christian's calling is, whether we're talking about civil justice, the application of the law here and now, being members of our government, members of parliament, members of the police force or whatever, that we're called to be salt into that situation and fight for something very different from what we see around us, and to affect then the whole society, or in the situation of war, to be prepared to make specific judgments and stand in judgment over against our society at particular points. I don't think that we really have the option biblically of withdrawing from that difficulty. Of course it's difficult, but rather to get stuck in and recognize that will put us sometimes in very awkward circumstances where it is going to be very hard to stand for God and for his word against the surgence of patriotism in a particular situation, which always arises as soon as there's a war of any kind, a conflict of any kind. Udo, if you'd like to comment on the German situation.
Well, just very briefly, I appreciate your comment. I think I started out saying there were so many who opposed Hitler's government, and then I stopped in mid-sentence and said, actually, there weren't that many. Because you're absolutely right. It was shameful how few Christians actually analyzed the situation right from 1933 on and did anything about it. My father actually at that time left the church, and he's never come back to Christianity, precisely because the Protestants had followed the Roman Catholics with their concordat and allowed Reichsbishop Müller to be appointed by Hitler as the Reichsbishop. And my father said, if the Protestant church goes along with this, I have nothing to do with it. And unhappily, there were very few who stood up against it. I'm not quite sure why, if Bonhoeffer, in fact, had left the pastorate before he was involved with Stauffenberg, why he did that. I don't think there's any necessity for that. I personally would feel much closer to many of the Dutch Christians who went into the underground and fought Hitler while they were pastors. We have a similar situation today in East Germany, where precisely by believing in this kind of a divided two-kingdom theory from Luther's emphasis, they basically feel that the appointed government is the existing government. I personally wouldn't hold that narrow a view. I think Paul in Romans 13... some very specific qualifications attached to the government that the Christian is to serve. For instance, a government that uses the sword to differentiate between good and evil. And in the first few verses, you three times have the root meaning of the verb that indicates order. So it's a government that creates order, that maintains order, that's appointed for order. It's that kind of government the Christian is to work with. It isn't just government for the sake of government or power for the sake of power. And therefore, I really find the possibility of a government that a Christian cannot work with a real possibility. And in that case, the question is, what do you do? And there may well be the situation in which, in fact, you do join the underground or start a revolution. I don't think that's the situation that's possible in East Germany at this time. There's a different kind of a revolution through a real spiritual work, through an intellectual work, through a cultural work that undermines the claim of the existing state to be the providers of a paradise for the workers and farmers of East Germany.
Now, I'd like to add to that, and again, just from my time in Poland, as I said earlier, all the Polish Christians I talked to said it was impossible for them to work with the state in the present situation. Not because they are against, in principle, Christians working in the situation, but given the kind of government they had at the moment, the patriotism or anything else would not encourage them to actually join it and work with it, because to do so would be disobedient to Christ. Now, of course, that's a very costly calling in any moment of history. And it seems to me the parable of the sower applies in that kind of situation very strongly, that when it's precisely when we're faced with such situations that the question of where our allegiance ultimately is comes out. Am I prepared to just go along with this situation, no matter how wicked it is? And appease my conscience by talking about patriotism? Or am I prepared to actually to stand and be counted and refuse to participate? But of course it's difficult.
Since Australia appears to be a sitting duck with recognised nuclear targets, for example, United States bases, should Australia have nuclear weapons ourselves? to act as a deterrent to this threat rather than rely on the umbrella of the United States?
That's a difficult one. Yes. Yeah, you're probably aware of the situation in Europe. And this is another point I wanted to make. Unfortunately, these days, the argument or the discussion about nuclear deterrence has become increasingly a political one of the right against the left. But I'd like to point out to you all, before I come to the particular question, that that has not historically been the case. And it still isn't the case in a great deal of Europe. For example, the French government, which has its own independent nuclear deterrent and is absolutely committed to it at the moment, as well as being a part of the whole NATO situation and relying too on the American umbrella, is a socialist government. Very much so. The same in Britain until a couple of years ago. All of our political parties, all three of our major parties, have been absolutely committed to the necessity of nuclear deterrence, both of having an American umbrella and also having an independent British nuclear deterrent. Up until the very recent past, and it's only in the last couple of years when our Labour Party has become increasingly dominated by the extreme left, that there has been, and because of the general resurgence of pacifism, that there has been a move against or a move towards unilateral disarmament by the Labour Party, and unfortunately it's now become a political discussion. Well, I don't think it is a political discussion in that sense at all of Labour parties, Conservative parties or whatever. I think it's very unfortunate when it becomes that way, because it certainly hasn't been that way going right back to the war. All the parties right across the political spectrum, except for the communists, all over Europe have been absolutely committed to the necessity of these things. Now, I would say yes. I do think Australia, New Zealand, Britain, West Germany, France, all the nations of the Western Alliance need to realise that we have a responsibility for our own defence. Now, I'm not suggesting by that we should leave the alliance. I think there's nothing the Soviet Union would like more. And if you read the papers at the moment, a great deal of Soviet propaganda at the present time is committed to trying to drive a wedge between Western Europe in particular and the United States. And we have to be realistic and acknowledge that is one of their objectives at the moment, without any question. And it's unfortunate, I think, that some of our people have seen that wedge is actually a good thing, and let's drive it further in ourselves. Coming back to what I and Udo were saying earlier. But I would say two things. I think, first of all, we do need to be committed to the alliance, and I don't see any problem whatsoever in recognizing that we need an American umbrella. It shouldn't hurt us to acknowledge that here is a nation that is far more powerful than we are, who has been committed to the defense of freedom. One only has to look at the difference between the nations of Western of Europe, which were liberated by the United States at the end of the war, and the nations that were liberated by the Soviet Union, to see how much it has been committed to freedom, comparatively speaking, historically. So I think we must be part of that alliance, but also I do think we need to be prepared to put more money and people into our own defense. I haven't any idea whether a nuclear deterrent is necessary for Australia, an independent one. I'm not sure I can answer that question. But certainly I think we have to be committed to our own defence and not just say, well, if only the Americans would go away, then we really don't need one and we'll be fine. That isn't the reality of the situation. I think partly it seems to me that one can say that a defensive system does two things. One, that actually does provide a deterrent. The second is that it actually acts as a reassurance for the people. And I think one of the reasons why it ceased to be a reassurance here in New Zealand and in Western Europe is because it's somebody else's weapons. rather than ours. We're in a situation like Switzerland, where the people are actually responsible for their own defence. They have a much more realistic view of the situation.
Yes, you spoke repeatedly during the course of your speech about God intervening in the affairs of man to vindicate one right or just government or nation as against another government or nation. Now, it would seem to me, applying a fairly common sense approach to the whole issue and looking to some of the scientific authorities, that if there's going to be a nuclear war of any scale at all, then its effects will be global and quite devastating on a global scale. Now, how can God vindicate one nation or government as opposed to another one when the whole world's going to cop it?
Yeah. I think perhaps you misunderstood what I said a little. I only spoke about God vindicating people in the context of Israel when I was pointing to somebody else's argument, who said that all we have to do is to trust God, and if we are righteous, then he will vindicate us today, just as he vindicated Israel. And then I looked back at the situation in the Old Testament. Now, I would say, yes, that I think God is still active in human history. And I think many people who were involved in the last war felt that it wasn't simply the fighting, the response of the Allies, which led to the defeat of Hitler. I'm sure you're aware that there are people who felt that Hitler's failure to invade Britain was something which was really miraculous and could never be explained in purely human terms. Many, many people who are not Christians felt that. And I think God still is active in human affairs, and that's how I really ended up, that God is in the end the ruler of the nations. Now, in coming to your other point, I said myself very carefully that I don't see any value whatsoever in an all-out nuclear war. And I don't see that any war that might take place in the future will necessarily lead to nuclear war. I pointed to the fact how in the last war, deterrence still worked, even in the context of war. So I have no desire whatsoever to see a nuclear war take place in the world. However, I think that we have to say that one can imagine situations where a limited nuclear exchange would be preferable to a long drawn out conventional war, just practically, precisely because it's so horrific. Again, I'd remind you that 50 million people died in the last war through being killed by conventional weapons. And I think if there had been nuclear weapons at the beginning of that war, it would have ended very, very much quicker, with very much less destruction of both people and the environment. Now, that's really all I can say. I don't know, Udo, you'd like to add anything to that?
I've got a second question to ask. I'd just like to add something to what you said during the course of your answer to my first question, and that is that although it's true what you say, if with a limited nuclear exchange, the overall damage, if you like, might be less rather than with a conventional type war. I think it's worthwhile pointing out that some of the damage will be long term in the sense of ecological changes and biological changes too. I'd just like to make that point known. My second question is this: how, as a Christian, can we justify this spending priority of building all these nuclear weapons to serve as a deterrent in the event of some attack upon us that might occur in the future, when right now there's 6 million people starving to death in Ethiopia,
right,
which is a reality, not speculation.
Thank you for the question. I'll just say something that I know Udo wants to respond to this too. Yes, I would say I don't think that we can ever argue for an either-or in this whole matter of defence on the one hand and the care for the poor, for the starving on the other. But we have to be committed to both, as I said repeatedly through my talk, both to the practice of justice and to the love of mercy. It cannot be an either-or. And I would say if there aren't some nations who are prepared to be vigilant and to have deterrence and to count that cost of what it means to stay free, there won't be anybody to help the people who are starving in the world. It's precisely because the West is free that it's been able to help the people in Ethiopia in the way that it has helped. I'm not saying enough has been done. I think as Christians we have a tremendous responsibility, both ourselves as individuals, in our churches, to give money to that situation, to give money to aid organizations which are helping in such situations, and also to put pressure on our governments to give aid in those situations. But it doesn't seem to me that it's an either-or. It's simply a both-and. Udo, perhaps you'd like to add something there.
Yeah, concerning your first comment about lasting results, I would say, I think in order to be fair to the total equation, we'd have to say the results of 50 million people dying under Stalin's purges are far more lasting, because nobody opposed him. And the same with the 12 million dead in China during the Cultural Revolution. And the 3 million dead in Cambodia. So it is true there's the tragedy that is possible because we don't know all the results. And the tragedy which we wish to avoid at all cost, if at all possible. But the equation is not, do we prevent lasting results from a limited nuclear exchange, or do we not prevent it, but rather at what price do we prevent it? And the price in human lives that have been eradicated has been beyond our possibility to imagine. And the second thing is, it seems to me again to be realistic, yes, I agree with Jeremy, more can be done and should be done. But we must also understand that the people who have been willing to spend a lot of money on preparedness are also the people who are making any kind of assistance possible, precisely because their orientation that makes the defense an expression of their valuing human life are also those who, out of that same value system, are creating the stuff that would help people and that, in fact, does help. Whereas the Soviet Union has only sent to Ethiopia 10,000 tons of grain, that's all, plus trucks, half of which the Ethiopian army has confiscated for itself. The hunger in Ethiopia is not primarily nature-induced, but rather is of political induction. Ethiopia under Haile Selassie was a feudal system, but in which, though there was not a satisfying situation and there was much need, yet nevertheless, certainly the Tigrayans up north produced sufficiently for themselves, and precisely, I think, because they were Coptic Christians. Their irrigation system is still intact, their forests still stand. But the rest of Ethiopia has not had that same philosophy. Now, under the present government for the last 10 years, you have a tragedy of forceful imposition of an atheistic system, that the declared purpose of which is the eradication of religion. You had in last September an expense of 100 and, what was it, 130 million, no, 130, yes, it was 130 million, I think, dollars on the celebration of the 10th year anniversary of the government coming to power, etc., etc. So what I'm saying is, yes, if in fact we could reduce the expense for military preparedness, we may have more to hand out, although the equation isn't as black and white as that, but we would. And which way could we reduce it? Certainly not by not being militarily prepared, but by really coming back to that moral understanding and obligation from the scriptures to in fact do things that are necessary for human survival in this world. You see, as I see it, the tremendous wasteful expense on armament is unhappily necessary because we in the West don't have the moral gumption and courage to say life matters to us to such an extent that we're willing to die for it. If we could somehow bring ourselves to really see it that way and communicate that to any potential enemy, then you don't have to have all the weapons in storehouses. They at present only replace that which we lack in our moral flabbiness. And then we could, in fact, have more to distribute. But what I'd like to come back to is that it's precisely, even in the West, the people who are willing to defend who make aid possible to an amazing measure.
Well, as an individual, I trust in God to protect me, and if I had the ability, I'd like to make sure that my percentage of the taxes aren't spent on nuclear weapons or furthering their development, and I think perhaps that is a desirable attitude that Christians should adopt. I don't think anyone's arguing that the two wrongs make a right.
Why would you say that?
Well, it would seem to me that to build nuclear weapons implies that you don't have enough faith in God to come to your rescue.
Where do you get that scripturally? That, first of all, there's a distinction between...
I'm not arguing on a point of scripture, just as a matter of common sense, I think.
Yeah, but the common sense is corrected by what the scriptures tell us, that there is room for a judicial system to punish the evildoer on every level, which certainly would contradict your perspective that one would only have to trust God. That's certainly not the picture of the Old and the New Testament.
I think we have to be realistic and to recognize that God calls us always both to trust him and to bear the sword. Was it in Nehemiah's day they built the walls, you know, with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other? And I'm sure they prayed at the same time. It's the same wherever you look through the Old Testament, that one has a calling to both of these things, both to take seriously our responsibility to defend ourselves and others, and also to commit our cause to God, because it's absolutely true. If God wishes to judge us because of our wickedness, just as he judged Israel on occasion because of their wickedness, no amount of defense is going to help us. So we have to pay attention to the justice and righteousness in our own situation. Otherwise, any amount of defense won't save us from anything.
Given a conventional war happening, do you differentiate between a Christian involvement in a defensive role and a Christian involvement in an aggressive role? And relating to that, a second aspect to the question is, how do you see the concept of preventative war, that is, striking out first to have the defensive advantage? Probably as an example, the mindset of the German military leading up to the First World War.
Well, Udo will have to comment on that, because I'm not sufficiently competent to do that in that particular situation. as I said, very, very carefully, that what we should be committed to is defence and not to aggression. If I felt that our governments were committed to aggression in the international scene, I wouldn't want to defend their expense on weapons or defences of any other kind, but I don't see that they are. Their statements are repeatedly that they are committed to defence. And I think we have reason to believe that. I think the other thing we can say at the moment is this too, that at the present time, it is actually possible for a Christian in our military services to disobey orders. I was interested a few months ago being at a meeting in which there were several Christians who were working on nuclear submarines. And of course they were asked this question. And they said yes. This was one of the things that was established, or confirmed if you like, by the Nuremberg war trials, that nobody could ever make the defense that they did something simply because they were told to by a senior officer. That they always had the right of refusal, of the conscience. And I think we are still in such a situation where that is a possibility. In terms of a preventative strike, I think you have to be realistic about war. That if it becomes really apparent that in some situation war is just about to break out, I think again you can look back to the 1930s and what was happening all over Europe. Anybody who had any eyes to see could see what was happening. But many people, like our own Prime Minister in Britain, preferred to bury their heads in the sand at the time and say, no, it won't happen. No, it won't happen, even though it was already happening. And theoretically, if Britain had declared war then earlier, you could have said that this was a preventative strike, but in terms of the actual realities of the situation, non-legalistically, it most certainly wouldn't have been. It would have been a response to something which was already clearly in existence and to clear indications of what Hitler's plans actually were. Now, Udo can comment on the first war situation because I don't know sufficient about that.
Probably before we go, Udo, I probably want to relate to the First World War because I'm doing some studies in it at the moment, and it seems to me there's a lot of things that led up to the First World War that are in actual play today. For example, there was the Anglo-German naval race, like we have an armament nuclear race at the moment, and there was the diplomacy ties and nations that tied into a diplomatic relationship which caused them to, of course, defend each other. And so what I'm relating, and of course the German mindset, again, like I just said before, had this concept of wanting to wage a preventative war because they had this myth of encirclement. And I just want to see how you would relate that to what's happening today.
Yeah, I think...
And the Christian's responsibility. As a Christian, can I, if my nation decides to strike it, you know, out in a preventative way?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what I'm trying to say is I could defend my nation on my soil, but I don't want to go overseas and fight a war overseas, which is what a lot of, actually some Australians had said during the First World War, I don't want to get involved in a European war.
Mm-hmm. Because you had no choice about its start. But there was more involved than that. The whole, I think World War One had a long build-up, as you say, the colonial competition, the naval competition, plus the fact that between first cousins, there was a rivalry within families, that already back in 1905, 1906, was in quite in public declared of such magnitude that it could only be settled by a war. They were saying that 8-9 years before they started the war, and the whole thing was a public competition which they realized could be resolved only in the defeat of one or the other of the powers. I think we're in a different situation, though not being a prophet of that kind, I don't know. I see certain parallels, but also real differences. And the differences that I see today is basically that we are not out to fight a war. And secondly, that blind optimism coming out of the evolutionary mindset of the 19th century, that there will not be a war, that there will be a, things are getting better and better and so forth, I don't think it's shared anymore today. Unhappily, through the tragedies of the wars of the 20th century, we have learned something about the human being that we're not quite as optimistic as people tended to be at that time. Remember, after all, that as late as 1903, people really thought that we were just at the threshold of a time in which there would be no more pain and eventually we'd lick death, etc., etc. Man was getting better and better and so forth, because the little bit of goodness that is in us is God's presence that manifests itself more and more and eventually would be just wonderful. Then there was a layer of a competition of culture or civilization, the competition between the two, that was going to be settled in the form of a war. We don't have that kind of a phenomenon today. Where there is a certain parallel is in fact in the expenditure for the military, though that doesn't stand in the same proportion to the actual GNP in our various countries as it did in pre-World War I, when the expense for the military swallowed up all the surplus that was created in the general industry. So yes, there are certain parallels, I agree, but there are also real differences. Yeah, the myth of encirclement is always used by advocates of a different approach to the Soviet Union by pointing out that the Russians have always had the fear of encirclement, which I agree they have had. And it's born, I think, out of the fact that their land is basically landlocked at least 6 months out of the year, because of the ice in the harbors in the Baltic and the Arctic Sea. And then there is this mystical component of Mother Russia and the earth that is a holy earth, etc. There is that. But I would say I don't think that stands up to scrutiny in today's discussion anymore, to the extent to which it is used by those who would advocate a different approach, for the simple fact that the Soviet Union's government policy, established policy, is not safety for Russia, but really is the expectation and the advocacy of a revolution all over the world, as the world waits the liberation that the materialistic, the dialectic materialism can offer. So there's a different ball game. I can understand the encirclement fear, because it's present. I think you may have quoted from this book here that points out that there's no country in the world that has rockets pointed at it from all around. There is that element. But underlying the Soviet phenomenon, not the Russian phenomenon, the Soviet phenomenon, is precisely a philosophy that's